We're talking today with Jonathan Schell, author of Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People. Jonathan, thank you for joining us today.
Great to be here.
Let me first ask you, what was your motivation in writing this book?
Well, whatever that motivation was, it happened more than a decade ago. It's been long in the making. I think I noticed a couple of things way back in actually about 1989. And one was that it seemed that the last of the great empires of the earth, namely the Soviet one, was tottering and on its way to collapse. And another was that the nuclear stalemate had really paralyzed war sort of in its upper ranges. And so on the one hand, you had violence becoming less and less useful for imperial purposes because all the other empires had already been overthrown. And then on the other hand, you had it really quite useless on that level of world war. And that seemed to constitute a very great transformation in the whole nature of warfare that we needed to catch up with and ask about. I think that was the original point of departure. And then it developed from there. It developed quite a lot. But.
And yet we still seem to be knee-deep, if not neck-deep, in some serious wars right now.
And how, you know. We've just finished one. They've got three or four others that seem to be on the charts. It's as if they're spinning the dial to decide which country to attack next. You know, would that be Syria, Iran, Libya, North Korea, France? Who knows? The way I see it, I don't believe in prediction. I don't believe that there are trends that inevitably play out in one direction or another. I really believe there are choices in history. And for instance, if you go back and look at the beginning of the 20th century, I think that the choice to plunge into the First World War was such a choice. And it wasn't a necessary thing. It could have been avoided. There was wiser counsel back then. But from that choice really flowed in a long progression, really a century of the worst violence that we've ever seen in history. And I think what frightens me very much now is that we appear to be at another such moment of choice. And we seem to have taken exactly the wrong path from my point of view. We seem to have chosen to try to solve our problems in the world with war. And so I'm afraid that if we keep on that road, we're going to have a 21st century that's as violent or worse than the 20th. But I think there is another way. There is another path to take. I think it is still open. I think it's common sense. I think it's possible. It's not utopian. It's realistic. And we still could choose it and save ourselves from that, as they did not back in 1914. So really, what my book is about, perhaps more than anything else, is trying to look for the real foundations in history, the real events that give encouragement that we have something to work with other than force, other than violence, which now means mass destruction.
Enlighten us on some of those things from history where that give you hope that we have another path.
Well, look at the Soviet Union. Where's the Soviet Union today? You know, the Soviet Union was one of the most heavily armed states except for the United States in all of history. They had nuclear arms. They had the entire Red Army. They had the KGB controlling every aspect of that society. If there was any political organization in the world that seemed unlikely to be undone either with or without violence, either by violent, not to speak of nonviolent revolution, if you had said, you know, in 1975 that there will be no Soviet Union in 1992 and that that will be accomplished without violent revolution or war, they would have locked you up. They would have just plain locked you up. You would have been regarded as a fool, dismissed as an idiot forever. And yet that is what has happened. Now, I don't think that we've taken stock of that. You know, people don't like to face bad news, but there's something in us that doesn't like to face good news either. You know, there's a resistance, there's a denial of good news, and that was a piece of good news. And we have to look deeply, and this is one of the things I try to do, to ask, what were the processes? What kind of power was it that turned out to be greater than the power of all that instrument of violence put together? So that would be an example. One other, I mean, without going into it, you know, the real Christopher Columbus of nonviolence was Mohandas Gandhi, of course, who developed it. And he helped to bring down the greatest empire of his time, which was the British, on which the sun never set. So and these are just two examples. So these are immense historical events. These are not trivial events. The end of the Soviet Union ended the Cold War. It was as consequential politically, economically, in every way you want to mention, as the outcome of the First or Second World War, except it wasn't a war. So we're talking about reality. I'm talking about what's real, what has really happened in history, and foundations that have been created that I think we could really build on for the future if only we would make that fundamental choice, which we have not made. And on the contrary, we're heading in an epically wrong direction, in my opinion, right now.
And when you say we are, we talking about just our current administration, or are we talking about the people of this country, or both?
I'm talking about the administration. I think the people of the country have been very divided about it. I mean, the president gets lots of support, and that's a fact. We know that from polling data. But if I don't sense a great warlike enthusiasm among the general public in the United States, I think what we do have is an unprecedented concentration of power in the White House, backed by these fantastic campaign contributions behind which are great corporations. They have at their fingertips this awesome military power, even though the Joint Chiefs of Staff didn't like the war in Iraq, but they had to go and do it anyway. It's media power, more and more. The mainstream media, not to speak of the new, you know, shock jock right-wing media, which is just like Chinese propaganda of 1953, just unrelenting diet of propaganda and downright lies. So it's a tremendous concentration of power. But I don't think that it comes from some kind of pathology in the public or something like that. To my mind, the public is rather moderate, and there's hope in that, because I think that the public can perhaps be reached. I think it will see that the consequences for it, in other words, the nation now is being sacrificed to the empire. I mean, look at the state budgets, look at education, look at health, look at welfare, look at anything you want to look at. Look at civil liberties, you know, look at the constitutional balances. Our country is being trashed so that we can go and trash Iraq and so on. You know, both sides of it are a disaster. You know, both sides are a disaster. Trying to run Iraq, trying to reinvent imperialism for the 21st century, and with really disastrous consequences at home. So I hope people will wake up to that and be awakened. I hope leadership will emerge. I hope political leadership will emerge. There hasn't been much yet, but it can.
So, and that leadership coming from both from the people and within our current political structure?
Well, so far it's come from the people, frankly. You know, before the war, you know, which I, as you know, or you see, I heartily opposed and do heartily oppose the Iraq War. Really, you would have expected to get some leadership from the Democrats in the Congress, let's say. They folded up completely. The media, equally bad, taken as a whole, you know. So, nevertheless, in spite of that, there was this very vigorous, energetic, numerous anti-war movement that was out in the streets and was doing in vigils. This has been underreported. The vigils all over America, in little towns, smaller cities. You know, we saw the big demos in New York and Washington. But almost more important were these local manifestations. So that, to me, was hugely hopeful. And remains hopeful for the future, because I don't think those people, you know, they're going to have to retool. Right now, everybody's saying, what's next? What do we do now? Where do we devote our energies? You know, what do we do? But I don't think the energy is going to go away.
You spoke when talking about the beginnings of World War One that the people in power had failed to listen to wiser counsel, and yet that seems to epitomize what we've currently got going on in D.C. When we had the incredible turnouts on February 15th in many cities, which were the largest turnouts, to my knowledge, that these cities had ever had against or for anything, our current man in power in D.C. had said, oh, I treat it the same way I would a focus group.
Yes, that was an amazing comment. You know, not only were there hundreds of thousands in the United States, but all over the world it was, I mean, you could state, and you could prove this, you could say the human species opposed the war in Iraq. I mean, public opinion polling showed that 90% in Spain, only the leader, only Aznar, the prime minister of Spain, was for 90% of the I was in Barcelona recently, city of 4 million people. 1 million people came out to oppose the war. Same thing in Britain, France, Germany, everywhere you want to look. So that's a very, very significant political fact. It's significant for the political futures of those countries. I mean, after all, you've already had several countries where it's been decisive. In South Korea, the current president who meets today with Bush was elected on a platform of opposing these new imperial policies, especially in regard to North Korea. Same in Germany. Schroeder was going down the tubes until he started opposing the Iraq war, and then he squeaked it through, you know. So this is full of political. Now they have to deal with those two regimes, and they can't just overlook that and dismiss that. So it's a very, very huge and important fact for the future. It's very hard to run the world when the world doesn't want you to run it.
Based on our history and how our media has covered history, I think a lot of people are very well acquainted with the way that violent power works and the steps that one goes through to use that. Yet nonviolence doesn't, again, hasn't been covered very much in the media. And I think a lot of people in our hearts might be seeking that path or would certainly like to, you know, learn more about it. Yet there doesn't seem to be a lot of coverage of the steps that are necessary to reach that.
True, it's absolutely true. And honestly, for me, the process of writing this book was a process of discovery by looking at history and writings of what that is and how much it is actually accomplished. I think one great example would be the Solidarity movement in Poland, where, you know, 10 million strong at one point, which really I regard as the kind of beginning of the unraveling of the Soviet Empire. It was there that it really showed that that totalitarian system could be fought and defeated from within, even though it went on to take another 10 years. But what they discovered was something absolutely basic and remarkable. And it surprised them as much as it surprised anybody else. Because what they did was they said, all right, let's organize for very limited objectives, right in our factories, right in our schools, right in our homes, and then let's link together and try to win that, a free trade union, a certain amount of free speech, a few welfare things, like roll back on a few on some prices, a free press within our group. They said, let's just concentrate on that. Let's leave state power to the, you know, Soviet-sponsored regime. And so they organized and they agitated. And they won those things. But the next thing was the most surprising part, because it turned out that if you mobilized an entire society in that way, it was not just these or limited objectives. They called it the self-limiting revolution. State power fell in their hands. And that was a discovery. That was amazing. I mean, actually, if you go back and read Gandhi in India, he said it. He said that the power of a state depends on the cooperation of the government, governed. Even a repressive state does. So if you stop going to the office, you stop obeying the commands of that government, they're just barking their orders into thin air, and it doesn't matter, and you just go ahead and build your own government. And this is what people's have learned, and I think it's the specific process. It's at the heart of the specific process by which they defeated empires. By the way, I think that's true even of the American Revolution, which did involve violence. But John Adams, for instance, at the end of his life, he wrote wonderful letters. He learned that somebody was going to be writing a military history of the Revolution, and he protested violently in his letters to Jefferson and others. He said, He said the revolution was over before the war started. He said the revolution was in the hearts and minds of the people, and it occurred when the people of the United States took charge of their own affairs. And he said the war was the defense of a revolution that was already completed. So that's quite a different picture. That's John Adams about the American Revolution. So there is a power. It's something, in a certain way, it seems sort of mystical or strange or surprising. But in another sense, it's the simplest thing in the world. It simply means people getting together, finding common ground, acting in concert to do the things they think need doing in their own community, in their own countries, and eventually in the world. And it just turns out that if you do that energetically enough and you get enough people to do that, that all the forces of violence in the world can't stop you.
It also sounds like that form of power has some degree of tangency with the democratic process, where a lot of the participants have a voice in what's going on.
Well, that's the very ideal of democracy. I mean, democracy, you know, shouldn't be just the laws and the newspapers. Democracy is people in action. You know, when Tocqueville came to the United States in the 1830s, he found, you know, what he called civil associations, this fantastic political vigor, people founding organizations to fix the roads, to abolish slavery, to have prohibition, whatever they wanted, this boiling activity. And I'm afraid we've gotten away from that, and I think we need to rediscover it again.
Again, another one of the definitions that seem handed to us, or the impression I have, is the whole one of power, and it seems more often than not to be equated with violence.
Well, exactly. Those two of power and violence, power and force, have really become almost synonyms in political literature. But there have been a number of thinkers, and one of the most interesting and one that I admire the most is Hannah Arendt, who said power and violence are actually opposites. Now, that was a surprising thought. And she pointed, actually, in the 1950s and 60s to the Soviet suppression of the rebellions in Eastern Europe, and she said this is a classic case of violence, of a contest between violence and power. And although you can win a quick victory, the price in terms of your power, of the Soviet power, over the long run is going to be very great. She was the only one who saw that because they were losing the whatever cooperation or support they had from the people. They were becoming a kind of hollow shell, so to speak. And then when the moment came, when people rebelled, the whole thing just crashed down in almost, it seemed, minutes. It was so enervated because it was deprived of what she regarded as the true lifeblood of power, which is the same as what Gandhi thought it was, which is the active, positive cooperation, support, participation of the people in the country.
In the subtitle of your book, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People, it sounds like a lot of this really stems from the will of the people.
The will of the people is everything. And, you know, sometimes we think that because there is a people, there must be a will of the people. And that's not necessarily true. And right now, I would say that in the United States, or maybe it's not, maybe it was even more true in the 1990s, the public pretty much turned away from politics. You know, if you followed the NASDAQ averages, that was pretty much the definition of citizenship in that time. I mean, I think political activity fell off, protest movements, civil activity fell off, also voting nosedived to less than 50% in presidential elections, you know, about 35%, 30% in congressional elections. We really sort of forgot that politics is an essential part of the life of a country. So we became a people that, in a certain sense, didn't really have a will. We let the powers that be, the media consultants, the money, the politicians, the pundits, all of those people sort of fill a vacuum and to sort of shoulder aside the actual participation and will of the people. The levels of activity dropped very, very low. Well, maybe since September 11th, that at least will change. We'll see. It's too early to tell. But in order for the will of the people to prevail with or without violence, there has to be a will, and it has to be actively expressed. And we haven't exactly had that for a while.
It seems on one level that we're almost creating the conditions that will force that to occur.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating because it's as if somebody has said, all right, do you want to see what it looks like when you let the oligarchy, the plutocracy, take over and run the place? Okay, you get five or six wars. They're going to slash your health benefits. You're going to be out of a job. They're going to take away your freedoms. They're going to wreck the Constitution, you know, the balance of powers. They're going to rip up the environment. So how do you like that? So a question is being put to people. So if they want to develop a will, if people want to develop a will, in the United States, we're getting a golden opportunity to do it.
Your book is broken into sections, violence, nonviolence, the civil state, and the shape of things to come. Talk a little bit about the civil state. Is that the will of the people, or is that something different?
Yeah. You know, I see liberal democracy, such as the American Constitution or parliamentary systems in Europe, as being sort of formal structures that can express popular will when that is expressed. So it's kind of like a formalization of nonviolent power, or as I call it, cooperative power. I distinguish it from coercive power. In other words, if it's working right, then you are conducting your political affairs without coup d'etats, without people being tortured in the basements, you know, with freedoms and so on. So there's a deep kinship, in my opinion, between nonviolence and revolution and democracy in the state that follows. And we see that connection, you know, because almost everywhere that there have been nonviolent revolutions, there have been about a couple of dozen, you know, since about 1974, whether you're talking about Greece or Portugal, Spain, the Philippines, many Latin American countries, although it's not so clear there, Eastern Europe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Really a long list. You had changes, you had the fall of repressive regimes without violence and yielding to some form, better or worse, of at least formal democratic system. So I think that tie is very strong. Now, of course, at the same time, there are tremendous forces. And again, they're the ones I was referring to, military, corporate, international corporate, and so on, that are again closing in and seeking to throw back that development or render it meaningless, render it pointless. So the fight is never over.
What's your sense historically of where we're at now in this country? A lot of people would say, you know, we have an administration that's, you know, more draconian than ever. And yet the very people in the streets that appear to be parroting or supporting it are saying, no, they're supporting all your rights for free speech. You know, you have the right to go out and protest, even though you shouldn't be doing that. You should just be getting behind the flag and marching to it.
Yeah. Well, you know, we do have these rights, and you and I are having this conversation, and we're not wrapping it out between the cell walls of two prison cells. You know, we're on the radio here. That's great. But at the same time, the playing field is tilted, you know, almost to the vertical against opposing views. You know, look at this. Look at the situation in radio with this behemoth corporation, Clear Channel. You know, big contributor to the Bush administration, they start organizing or suggesting the organization of pro-war rallies and sending out the word on certain stations that certain artists that oppose the war shouldn't be run. Now, that is structural institutional power. Still, I do hold that we, because we formally do still have our freedoms and we can use them, and we are using them, that it is possible to turn this around. I feel that, to put it in personal terms, that I don't have the right to say I can give up now. I don't think we who are worried about these trends have done enough to have the right to say I give up. A lot more is asked, a lot more time, a lot more money, a lot more sacrifice before anybody can say, well, that didn't work, I give up.
Yeah, again, getting back to that key aspect of democracy that you had talked about earlier, the actually participating on a, yes. on a daily basis.
You know, our society is strange, and this is a little structural problem, I think, with liberal democracy, is that it really provides no structures in the Constitution for this kind of participation. You know, Thomas Jefferson had a little slogan, which was divide the counties into wards. Hannah Arendt speaks about this in her book on revolution. What he wanted the United States to do was to set up what in effect would have been a system of nationwide town meetings of the kind that you have alone in New England, or mostly in New England, I think, so that the citizens who had just been through this exhilarating experience of the revolution would be able to continue that participation directly connected to the government in several forms. But that isn't in the Constitution, and that doesn't exist in most parliamentary democracies either. So the riddle and the problem is it's got to be self-starting. You just have to appoint yourself to go out and do that. Say, well, nobody's asked me, but I just hate the way things are going. I have to get out there and do so. I have to talk to my neighbor. I have to talk to the PTA. I have to organize the PTA. I have to go and work for a candidate. I have to get busy. But it's a matter of self-appointment because we don't have those structures, and we have to reinvent it every time. We have to reinvent the whole thing all over again.
So do you see your book as being one of the sparks that gets this going?
Well, that would be my dream, that it would help. I hope it will be helpful. We'll see.
All right. And you had said you don't do predictions, but do you feel fairly hopeful that in this country we can get things turned around relatively soon and start actually carrying out the will of the people?
You know, there's a real enough possibility that we should be working for it. I mentioned before the Vietnam War, which I was a reporter there in Vietnam, and then I came back and I opposed the war editorially and in my writing and in other ways. You know, in 1963, 1964, Democratic president was getting us into the war, two Democratic presidents. It was not a Republican administration. If you flat out opposed that war, and if you said, this war is a disaster for the United States, you know, what were you, 10% of the population? You did not have access to mainstream organs of opinion at that time. And yet, over a period of years, that changed. That was turned around. And now there's a much more significant segment of opinion that is opposed to this whole imperial direction, this hegemonic direction that the United States is taking. So it's a developing situation. And if I'm right about it, it's going to run into heavy weather very soon. It's already running. You know, this morning we had the bombings in Saudi Arabia. Iraq is falling into chaos. We have one proconsul there, Jay Garner. He couldn't hack it. He couldn't do it. They yank him out, put in another guy, so-called civilian. What does that civilian do? He's a counterterrorism expert. That's his specialty. That's the game the United States is in, not about building democracy in Iraq. That's looking more and more like a royal mess. So the situation is developing, and there are going to be more opportunities for opposition and protest as we go along, including in the economic sphere.
All right, we've been talking with Jonathan Schell, author of Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People. Jonathan, thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you. Great. Real pleasure.